Well, it's a great pleasure to be back with you again today. Told last night the story, sort of in brief compass, of how I think the modern understanding of what it means to be an individual human person has emerged. And it was really a broad brushstroke story that sees the, on the one hand, the collapse of traditional forms of external authority. On the other hand, a move inwards to find our identity in terms of feelings. And I talked about what I call, borrowing a term from the sociologist Robert Beller, expressive individualism, that we now live in a world where we tend to think of ourselves as primarily our feelings, and we tend to understand authenticity, or achieving, we might say, our full personhood or our full humanity in terms of being able to act publicly in terms of those feelings and to have those actions affirmed by those around us. And I also commented that perhaps one of the peculiarities of the modern age is how much a matter of sexual desire has come to play into that. If you look at the Old Testament, for example, there's a lot of stuff in the Old Testament about sexual activity. But the Old Testament really thinks in terms of actions, not in terms of identities. Today, we intuitively think about these things in terms of identity. To describe oneself, for example, as lesbian, gay, or straight does not necessarily say anything about any experience we may have had or any action we may have taken. We're actually identifying ourselves in terms of those inner feelings. So that, in brief compass, is what I was trying to set forth last night. Today, I want to make you aware of, or remind you if you're already aware, of how much of apparently unrelated aspects of the modern world reinforce this in our thinking. I think one of the important things that Christians must do when faced with challenges is, first and foremost, avoid that the Pharisaical attitude of, I thank you, Lord, that I'm not like other men, and rather ask that other question that the disciples asked on a particular occasion, is it I, Lord? I think we need to realize that the issue we're facing in many ways often presents itself as an us versus them kind of thing, but actually arises out of a world in which we are all deeply embedded and in many ways complicit. So I want to speak today about various aspects of the modern world that give us insight into the stuff I talked about last night, but also bring out how deeply immersed in this we are ourselves. I want to begin with a quotation from the great play by the German genius, Goethe. Goethe's greatest literary contribution, of course, was his version of the Faust story, the story of the man who sells his soul to the devil. Goethe's Faust, in one of the first encounters that Faust, Dr. Faustus, has with Mephistopheles in Goethe's great play, Mephistopheles presents this temptation to Faustus, and I quote, "My dear sir, you're looking at things in a conventional way. We must do better than that, or the joys of life will escape us. Hang it. You have your hands and feet, you have a headpiece and a codpiece, and anything else you can enjoy is yours, isn't it?" Then comes the really significant couple of sentences in this quotation. "If I can afford a coach and six, isn't their energy mine? I can ride around proudly as if I had 24 legs." Re-quote that last bit again. "If I can afford a coach and six, isn't their energy mine? I can ride around proudly as if I had 24 legs." Why do I quote that? I quote that because Mephistopheles is presenting Faust there with a temptation that I think the modern world has seized with both hands. And the temptation is this: to allow technology to fundamentally change what it means to be a human being. It's the 80th anniversary of the lectures that C.S. Lewis gave that were to become, a few years later, his famous and influential little book, The Abolition of Man. And one of the points that Lewis raises in that work is the impact of technology. Of course, writing at the height of the darkest hour, in many ways, of the Second World War, Lewis would have been acutely aware of how technology had reshaped how human beings relate to each other. That was 80 years ago. We have far more powerful technologies now than Lewis had in his day. And I want to make us aware today, and really as a way in some ways of underlining the difficulty of responding to the situations in which we now find ourselves, I want to underline the way in which technology has fundamentally changed how we think of ourselves and what we think it means to be human. It's the Faust temptation. Faust can buy a coach and six. Isn't the energy of the horses his? Isn't he transformed? And I want to start by looking perhaps at something a little unexpected. First time I gave a version of this lecture was at a college where I'd been. Well, I contacted them on the Tuesday. The person of the college had contacted me, and out of the blue, I thought, "Am I going to be protested at this college?" And so I dropped him a note, and I said, "I'm not going to be protested, am I?" And he said, "Oh, no, 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 nothing like that ever happens here." And then he picked me up at the airport on the Wednesday, and as I get into his car, he said, "I've got to bring you up to speed on something." So I had a group of protesters. As a big believer in the right to protest in a democratic society and the right to free assembly, I have no problem in people turning up to protest, as long as they're polite and civilized. Don't throw paint on my tie or anything like that. They were a very civilized group of protesters. They actually sat and listened to the lecture. I tested them early on by throwing out a joke, because I could see who they were. And when they laughed at the joke, I thought, this is going to be a really friendly protest. And they decamped to another part of campus to protest me after the lecture. And this was a personal thing. They were protesting myself and a woman called Lila Rose, who'd spoken at the college earlier in the week, and she's a big pro-life campaigner. And I was told by somebody who went along to see what was happening that what they were doing at the protest was they were reading offensive things that Lila Rose and I had written. And what was fun was, as far as I could gather, Lila Rose tweets, so they were able to just read tweets for her. Apparently, they were having to read whole paragraphs from me because I don't think in 160 characters or whatever it is. So to find something truly offensive, you've got to do a whole paragraph of stuff that I said. But what I wanted to do is I was thinking that night before the protest, I thought, I'm going to wrong foot these protesters by focusing upon what might be the most significant technological innovation for the transformation of what it means to be human that they will never have thought of. Music. I want to spend a few minutes this morning thinking about music. You might think, well, that's crazy because I've come here to hear about the modern self. I want to suggest that music is key to how the modern self has been transformed. Think about music. I'm not familiar with every culture throughout history, obviously, but every culture with which I have some familiarity has music. Music seems to be an important part of human life. It interests me, in my other life as a Reformation academic, I was always interested that the two things that the Reformation brought back to the heart of Christian worship was the spoken word and corporate singing. Isn't it interesting that I think the two things that human beings do that no other creature on the face of the planet does is we have linguistic capacities, and I don't care how many monkeys you teach to order a Diet Coke by pushing bits of plastic around, that is not language as we use it. Language as human beings use it is incredibly supple and complicated. We write poetry. We do amazing things with language that no monkey will ever do with a piece of plastic. And we make music, and we can hear music. I'm told that apparently human beings have a brain physiology, etc., etc., that means we can hear music in a way that no other creature can. Isn't it interesting that the Reformation, those two things get restored? I wonder if that connects to the image of God. I can't make a tight biblical case for that. It's very interesting, isn't it, that if human beings have the image of God, that's what makes us distinct from all other creatures. Language and music lie at the heart of that. Well, let's think about music. Music. Every culture, which I'm aware, has music, and music has always had a communal significance. Key events in communal life have typically been marked by music. At a wedding recently, there's music. We've just sung a couple of hymns, worshiping God. There's music. Funerals often have music. Music of lamentation. Parties where people just get together and have fun with each other often have music. Communal music, very important to human life. It's something, we might say, that forges the community, that marks the community. We see that from the way in which music has functioned in communities that suffer. Think of the African-American spiritual tradition, a distinctive form of musical spirituality that arises out of the suffering of slavery. Think of the Psalms. Many of the Psalms are concerned with exile and suffering and the apparent absence of God. Psalm 88, great example. And the Psalms, of course, we read them typically in our daily devotions as sort of private poems, but they were originally written to be communally sung. Think of the rich traditions of ballads and folk songs. I live, I suppose, it's sort of just beyond the northern tip of Appalachia. But think of the tradition of Appalachian music. Think of the tradition of folk ballads in England through the Middle Ages. Music arises out of and reflects communal life. It's a product of communal life, and it's a way of realizing communal life. It was also of necessity live. And this is where I'm starting to move into the big shift on music. It was of necessity live. A major cultural moment happens when music can be stored, you know, on those old wax cylinders, and then on 78s, on vinyl, and then on CDs, and now, of course, on iPods, Spotify, etc., etc. Prior to the invention, though, of the phonograph, the experience of music had to be live. To enjoy music, you've got to make it yourself, or you've got to go and be present where somebody else was making it. The very nature of music, technically, technologically, was live and communal. Now hold that in your mind. Today, I'm guessing if you're anything like me in this room, today music will play a big part in your daily life. You will experience music every day. But you will experience music privately. Music has moved from being a matter of corporate communal production to being something that is primarily a matter of individual consumption. Now think about that. You might say, well, so what? We're just getting music. It's just more convenient now. I want to say no. Music now functions differently to the way it did 300 years ago. 300 years ago, music functioned as a way of reminding you, making you, reinforcing the fact that you were a member of the community, that you did not exist in isolation. Now, music does the opposite. Music allows you to think that you are an isolated individual, sovereign in your own domain. You know, this dates me. You know, at Spotify, you know, there will never be another Pink Floyd. And that's to me, that's a sad thing. But why will there never be another Pink Floyd? Because you can't have concept albums anymore. I've got these playlists on Spotify that play the music I want to play in whatever order I choose. I'm king. Even vinyl had a certain authority to it that no longer applies. Not only do I consume music privately, I consume it absolutely on my own terms, without reference to any community or communal obligations whatsoever. That which once made me and reminded me that I am only me in connection with an independency upon an obligation towards other people is now that which tells me I'm an isolated, sovereign, unencumbered individual. It's another part of that story I was telling last night. Remember, I made a comment. I can't remember if it was in the Q&A or in the lecture. But I made the comment to the effect that it's not arguments that make the world go round. It's intuitions and imagination. It's the stuff we don't notice that perhaps shapes how we think about ourselves most profoundly. How many of us have ever thought about, well, wow, listening on Spotify, that is leading me to think of myself in a way that is fundamentally different to the way I would have thought about myself 300 years ago. And as I think about myself differently, I think about everybody else and my relationships to them differently as well. Technology of music, which once brought us together, now drives us apart. I ask a question in class sometimes. I read with the students in my humanities class. We read together Robert Burns' wonderful poem, The Cotter's Saturday Night. Burns was a sort of godless womanizer. But he wrote this beautiful poem, The Cotter's Saturday Night, and the sort of shtick is this, I guess. Burns is sort of looking in through the window on a Saturday night of the house of a poor Scottish croft farmer as the family gather for Saturday evening worship, family worship, to prepare for Sabbath day worship the day after. And while Burns, as I say, godless womanizer, it is the most beautiful literary presentation of which I am aware of family worship. If you haven't read it, The Cotter's Saturday Night. It's a beautiful poem. And at one point, they gather round the ingle, and the patriarchal father takes down the old family Bible, and he takes off his hat, and he reads from the Bible as he calls the family to prayer. What's interesting, they gather round the ingle, the old fireplace. I say to students, you know, think about the old design of front rooms. You had a fireplace. What do fireplaces do? Well, they become the focal point. You arrange your furniture around them. My wife and I have a living room. There's a fireplace there, and our furniture is arranged broadly in a kind of curve so that when you're sitting there in the winter and the fire is on, the fire is the center of attention. And what do fireplaces do? They bring families together. They bring people together. They facilitate person-to-person interaction. Now, move from the Truman living room to the Truman sunroom. The sunroom, it perhaps conforms more to the architecture of the modern home, because we have a focal point in the sunroom as well. It's called the television. And it, too, has the same effect on the kind of arrangement of the furniture. We arrange the furniture in a way that we focus on the television. But what does the television do? The television actually carries us away from each other. The television doesn't facilitate conversation between those gathered. It silences that conversation and carries us to wherever the TV takes us. The TV room is a room full of individuals. A room with a fireplace is a room with a community. Think about that. I read an article, I don't know if it's entirely true, an article maybe 5 or 6 years ago saying that American architects were no longer going to be building houses with dining rooms, because dining rooms aren't used anymore. They're considered a waste of space. Witnesses to the death of the communal meal. Think about all these things. Think about all these things and the way they shape how we think about ourselves. The problem in the modern world is not primarily the LGBTQ movement. That is a function of a deeper problem. And the deeper problem is the emergence of the idea that we are sovereign individuals connected to and answerable to nobody else except those to whom we choose to enter into contractual relationships. So my first point about music, technology. We need to realize that technology shifts the way we think about ourselves in fundamental ways. And this, of course, is going to make, so what's the answer, much more complicated. You know, the answer is not electing the right guy as president, or getting the right Supreme Court justice. Those can be very good things. I'm not knocking them, don't get me wrong. But they don't solve the deeper problem of how we think about what it means to be a human being. We swim in this water that makes it very, very hard for us to imagine humanity in the way that I think the Bible conceptualizes humanity. And we are all involved in that. We cannot extract ourselves from that in any easy or clean way. Think about, as we think about this, the question of who are you, think about how technology has transformed the medical field. Medicine has moved from being, in our world, primarily restorative to being transformative. What do I mean by that? Well, think about the most obvious example, I suppose, the low-hanging fruit example would be plastic surgery. Plastic surgery. There are examples of plastic surgery that go back to the ancient world, but modern plastic surgery, I think, really starts to take off in Britain after the First World War. Why? Because so many young men came back from the trenches with their bodies fundamentally damaged. And plastic surgery was developed as a way of trying to restore some sort of basic human dignity to those who had had their physical dignity torn from them in the trenches. But think about that. It was restorative. Plastic surgeons after the First World War, we might say, operated with a normative notion of what it meant was meant to be a human being. And their goal was to take this person whose face had been badly burned by mustard gas or whatever, blown away by a shell or torn up by shrapnel, and to try to restore it to what it once was. Think about how plastic surgery operates now. Transformative. Become transformative. Think about the trans issue we face in our culture. Trans issue is predicated on the idea that, say, the body is Play-Doh and the feelings are everything. And if the feelings and the body stand at odds with each other, then so much the worse for the body. It is the body that must be treated, not the mind. Thought experiment. 100 years ago, if you went to your doctor and said, I think I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, if your doctor was a compassionate sort, he would certainly have said, that's a problem and I need to help you. We need to treat your mind, to bring your mind into conformity with your body. Today, if you go and ask, say that to your doctor, the answer will come back, well, that's a problem and I want to help you. We need to bring your body into conformity with your mind. How has that taken place? Fundamental transformation of what it means to be human, fueled by the possibilities of surgery. You can only give that second answer in a world where certain things already apply. And one of them is that you have lost a normative understanding of what it means to be an embodied human person, and you have developed technologies that allow you to believe that that is plausible. We see it in other areas. Gene editing. Other surgeries geared towards psychological therapy. The realities of nature, we might say, are much easier to subjugate to the ambitions of desire now. We can imagine that. Why can we imagine that? Because of the advances of technology. Think about sexual morality. One of the big shifts, one of the interesting things about sexual morality over the years is, well, first of all, I'm struck by the fact that typically and traditionally, sex has been regarded as somehow sacred. You see that in the Old Testament. The Old Testament, much of the Old Testament law is preoccupied with two things. Stuff related to sexual activity and stuff related to death. Both of which, interestingly enough, connect to the body. All kinds of rituals and ceremonies relative to those things. And they're thought of typically in terms of cleanness and uncleanness. Sexual activity typically had a sacred quality to it. Checked with a Muslim friend last week, and in Islam, apparently you have to engage in a special washing after sexual activity before you engage in prayer. If you look at Hinduism, Hinduism has a god of sex. Ratu, I think, is his name. Sex has typically been, by societies, been regarded as sacred. And there are good reasons for that. A couple of reasons, I think. One of them is, of course, sexual activity is typically associated with that most mysterious of things, the creation of new human life. Where are human beings most godlike? In the creation of new life. Any of you who are grandparents will know it's an amazing experience to hold your grandchild for the first time. There's that verse in the Psalms, may you live to see your children's children. And I always thought that that was just a statement of may you live a long time until I held my granddaughter. And then I realized that's not actually not just saying may you live a long time. It's actually wishing a peculiar blessing upon you. And it's something of a miracle when you hold in your hands life created by life that you yourself created. It's a peculiar blessing, that is. Well, that's one of the reasons why sex was regarded as sacred. I also think that sex was regarded as important, if not sacred, because it typically marked a move from childhood to adulthood. The first licit sexual experience typically followed a public ceremony, a marriage of some kind. And just as an aside, there's an interesting reaction in feminism at the moment against the sexual revolution. And I saw, I think it was in the New York Times, my son sent me a link to an article by a woman arguing that we need some way of legally formalizing a situation whereby men who get women pregnant have obligations towards the children. My son sent it to me in a text and he said, Dad, is this what people of your generation called marriage? And I said, yeah, it certainly sort of fits that kind of broad bill on the whole. But marriage was important. Sex had communal significance because it marked a move into adulthood, and typically it was accompanied by the production of children. And therefore it had significance not just for the couple involved, but for the broader community as well. Think about how, even in Christian circles, technology has transformed the notion of the purpose of sex. We now, I think, as a society as a whole, think about sex first and foremost as recreation. That's an interesting move. An interesting move. Abigail Favalli, in her, I think it's in her book, The Genesis of Gender, makes the comment that sex has always had a procreational, a recreational aspect to it. What's interesting today is that the default switch is on recreation, not procreation. Interesting comment. But to think about sex as recreation, you need to live in a certain kind of world. You need to live in a world where sexual activity as recreation is relatively safe. You need to live in a world where you can either prevent or get rid of unwanted pregnancies fairly easily. You need to live in a world where there are antibiotics in order to deal with the diseases that you may pick up through irresponsible sexual activity. You need technology. Need technology. And then when you think about how the shift from sex to sex as recreation, the shift to sex as recreation, it makes that thing which brought two people together, is something that increasingly focuses upon what you can get out of it. It tilts you towards seeing the other person as an object. It tilts you towards seeing them as an instrument serving your ends. That lies at the heart of expressive individualism. Other people, I said, become first and foremost a threat, and secondarily, good, providing they meet your needs. The philosophy of sex as recreation, fueled by technology, does precisely that. And that, I think, is why we are seeing such an interesting reaction among feminists against the sexual revolution. Because the feminists are finally cottoning on to the fact that the sexual revolution actually turns women into objects. Very interesting, I won't give names, but three Roman Catholic friends of mine were in Rome. And they were in Rome on business, and they went to a bar and that evening. And there were three English girls in the bar. And these three men are married, good godly men, married. And the three girls started flirting with them. And so one of these guys thought he'd play a game with these girls. He said, if you can guess how many children we have between us, we'll buy you a drink. And the three guys, so the girls came back with answers like 5, 6, 7. I think the answer was 25. Yeah, these are big families. But what was interesting, my friend told me, was when he gave this answer of 25, the girls went very quiet. And they then engaged in a 2-3 hour conversation with these girls, asking these guys, where can we find guys who will be as committed to us as you clearly are to your wives and your families? Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? That's not the reaction I'd have expected. My friend said it was amazing. These girls, they wanted to know where could they find somebody who would be committed to them to the extent that we are committed to our wives. Sex as recreation, technologically fueled, adopted, I think, in large part by great swathes of the culture, including many Christians, has really created a situation which reinforces the idea of us as free-floating individuals to whom other people are merely objects. I was going with my wife. We were on a walk in a town in Philly, near Philadelphia the last year, and we walked through a pro-abortion protest. And we noticed one of the signs, and the signs read, consent to sex is not consent to pregnancy. And I thought, well, that's an interesting sign. Because 100 years ago, it would certainly have been consent to pregnancy by at least one of the parties involved. That sign only makes intuitive sense to us today because our thinking about sex has been so completely transformed by technology. And I want to suggest that given the importance of sex, it was so important it was considered sacred, that when a culture shifts its attitude to sex, it is not the equivalent of adjusting the legal age for purchasing alcohol or the speed limits on the federal highways. It is something that goes to the very heart of what a society thinks it means to be a human being. Sex as identity. I mentioned this last night. It's why I try to avoid ever referring to myself as straight. Because as soon as you think of yourself as straight, you're playing the game. I am not my sexual desire. I'm not identified by my sexual desire. I'm a husband. I'm an employee. I'm a Christian. I'm a father. I'm a grandfather. I am not my sexual desire. My sexual desire is an important component of my life, but I will not identify myself by it because that opens up the grammar and the syntax of the sexual identity revolution. It legitimates it. Think about pornography. I think many people today are rightly concerned about the terrible effects that pornography is wreaking without and within the church. Christians often tend to focus upon the lust that it promotes. It also promotes, I think, a particular philosophy of what it means to be a human being. Obviously, it objectifies the other. The person watching has no investment in those appearing on the screen. It is very cheap from that perspective. I think it's also a desecration of the human person. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. But I think human beings are bodies. One of the weaknesses of the Christian world, certainly the Protestant Christian world, is we've sort of lost sight of that to some extent. I don't know what the policy in your churches in Michigan was during COVID. I was struck, and this is not a criticism of any particular policy, but I was struck at how many Protestants found it a matter of indifference that they no longer went to church in person on a Sunday. Now, it may have been the right thing to have shut down church, certainly at the beginning when nobody knew what was happening. Is it the Black Plague? That kind of thing. I don't want to comment on that. But it struck me as interesting in Protestantism that so many people just sort of shrugged their shoulders about it. They didn't think they'd lost anything by not being present in bodily form. I think that points to a deeper weakness in Protestantism, that we tend, on the whole, to think of ourselves as souls, not bodies. And the soul kind of spookily inhabits the body as a man might inhabit a spacesuit. I want to make the case we are our bodies. When Adam sees Eve and declares, "This now is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," he's talking about Eve. He's not saying, "Oh wow, there's now a spacesuit in front of me whereby that spooky thing that is me can occupy another spacesuit." Eve is bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. I don't have time here, but in class I argue, Adam truly becomes Adam when he sees Eve. It's then that he truly understands who he is at that point, because he sees her body. What does pornography do? Pornography desecrates the human person. How? You might say it's preoccupied with bodies. Yeah, but with the bodies as depersonalized lumps of meat. Properly ordered sex is not about depersonalized lumps of meat. Use an analogy to illustrate this to the students in class. I say, imagine there's always one or two of them engaged in class. And I say, okay, you're engaged. When's the wedding date? June 2nd or something. It's a Christian liberal arts college, so they all tend to get married the day after graduation. That tends to be how it works. And I'd say to them, okay, on the day of the wedding, the groom's waiting at the front, the bridesmaids have all processed in, the music changes, the bride enters, the groom intuitively turns around at that point because he wants to see the woman on the big day, and he sees not Deborah, his fiancée, but Julie, an equally beautiful and delightful young woman, walking down the aisle towards him in a wedding gown. Does he go through with the ceremony? Of all the students I've asked, only one has ever said to me, probably not. It happened to be the day that his fiancée was absent from class. And I actually said to him, would you like to reconsider the word probably in that answer? And he immediately did. But of course the answer is, of course not. Because although sex is a big part of marriage, you're not marrying a sexualized piece of meat. You're marrying a person. Use the language of the great late great English philosopher Roger Scruton. You're interested in a face, not a body. In pornography, we're taught that any body will do. In properly ordered human relationships of love, only the face will do. It's not the sex that matters, it's the person. Pornography turns faces into bodies. It dehumanizes us as it dehumanizes other people. It turns desire for a particular person into a general desire for personal satisfaction. And in doing so, it changes the way we think about ourselves. And finally, transhumanism. One of the things that I missed in the two books I wrote, I treated the transgender issue very much as part of the LGBTQ. And I did that in part because, well, mainly because it is part of the LGBTQ in terms of politics. The LGBTQ is an alliance, really, against what one might call heteronormativity in society. That's what unites them. What I missed, of course, is that actually transgenderism is very different to LGBT stuff, LGB stuff, not simply because the L, the G, and the B sort of affirm the important physical distinctives of the body, sex body, but also because the L, the G, and the B are movements of sexual desire, and the T is not. I mentioned at breakfast, we have these interesting situations where a man will transition to being a woman, but remain married and in love with the woman that he's been married to all this time. It's clear that the T is not a straightforward sexual desire issue. So what is it? Well, this I missed. What it is it's a transhuman issue. It's a species of transhumanism. What is transhumanism? It is the deployment, it is the idea that we can transcend our humanity through the application of technology. It takes various forms. Some, will we download our brains into computers? Or will we merge our bodies with machines in such a way that we develop superhuman strength? Or even that we carry on living forever? Or at least until the sun, I gather, expands and swallows. I've always wondered, so how do the transhumanists overcome that bit where the sun expands and eats everything up and then implodes into a black hole? I'd rather be dead by that point myself rather than living and worrying about it. But think about that. Think about transhumanism. That starts to seep into the imagination. We start to think of the human body as a problem to be overcome. A problem to be overcome. Mary Harrington, brilliant English writer. I don't think she's a Christian or professes Christian faith yet, though she's becoming increasingly sympathetic to Christian ideas, it seems to me. She talks about the collapse of the importance of the body as a result of transhumanism and other factors in what it means to be human. When we socialize, she says, in disembodied ways online, even as biotech promises total mastery of the bodies we're trying to leave behind, these efforts to abolish sex dimorphism in the name of the human will end up abolishing what makes us human men and women, leaving something profoundly post-human in its place. In this vision, our bodies cease to be interdependent, sexed, and sentient, and are instead reassembled as a kind of meat Lego, built of parts that can be reassembled at will. Think about that. Think about how that is percolating into our consciousness. When we think about the strange new world is not strange just because things that were once regarded as immoral are now regarded as perfectly legitimate. Strange new world is not strange simply because sexual desire has become a mark of identity. Strange new world is strange because technology has facilitated the increasing collapse of any consensus about what it means to be a human being. That is the bad news against which I want to press some good news in the final lecture. Thank you for listening.